It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we examine the relationship between the U.S. and Iran from an Iranian perspective.
First, an issue that's become a hot-button topic in the Wisconsin gubernatorial election, the outsourcing of jobs. Governor Scott Walker's campaign released a controversial ad a few weeks ago, accusing Democratic challenger Mary Burke of making her fortune by outsourcing jobs.
The commercial was met with criticism for attacking a Wisconsin business. Governor Walker has doubled down on his message with this ad.
Mary Burke is trying to sell us on her experience at her family business, but she forgot to mention that they make 99% of their bikes overseas in places like China, where her company has outsourced jobs for years. Yet, while Burke's company makes almost all their bikes overseas, taxpayers have had to foot the bill to retrain the Wisconsin workers who lost their jobs here. Mary Burke, job creator? Not so much.
Here to talk about how Wisconsin business leaders are responding to the debate is Jack Craver. He's a reporter for the Capital Times. Jack, welcome back to the show.
How you doing, Rob?
Good. Well, before we get into the back and forth here, you have a recent piece on how the business community in Wisconsin is reacting to these ads. Outsourcing made a political football on both sides. We'll get into that. What's the business community saying here, though?
Well, naturally, the business community doesn't like to hear people bashing what is a pretty common business practice in America today. But what I noted in the article was a couple prominent examples of people involved in the business community who are telling both candidates to shut up about outsourcing because, from their perspective, it's just a part of running a business these days, especially a manufacturer, and they view it as fundamentally disingenuous. Particularly coming from a candidate such as Governor Walker, whose political career is basically premised on his ties to the business community and to doing what businesses believe they need to do to grow.
There's been some conservative criticism of the governor, and as you say, from the business community, his response is, I'm not opposed to outsourcing. I'm pointing out hypocrisy from this Democratic candidate. The Democrats are usually opposed to outsourcing, but here's one who's done it.
Yeah, sure. That you can say that, but the ad that you just played right there, that's not about pointing out hypocrisy. I mean, it can be a little bit, but I mean, it's clearly intended for viewers who will react negatively to the notion of a company making products overseas. I mean, that's the point. The point isn't just, he's not just calling on Mary Burke to be consistent. He's saying to people that she's shipped jobs overseas and that's a bad thing and you should vote against her for that. And it's, you know, this is a common tactic in politics. It comes more often from Democrats than Republicans because unlike the Republican Party, which is generally almost all been in favor of free trade agreements that typically are considered responsible for a lot of outsourcing, the Democratic Party is split on the issue. President Bill Clinton and Barack Obama pursued free trade agreements that the progressive wing of the party thinks, you know, aren't good and lead to outsourcing.
Well, and speaking of that split and worries about it, you pointed out that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin polled the public on Mary Burke's history and the outsourcing issue in particular before she announced her candidacy. Do you think that the party foresaw this was going to be a contentious issue come Election Day?
Apparently. And it's hard to know to what extent this issue would have been on the forefront if they hadn't introduced it by allowing that poll to leak. It's always been an issue for her even before Walker started attacking her on it. Progressive activists in the party, progressive media commentators, bloggers were going after her for it in the weeks after she declared her candidacy last year. Some said that this was just it's not appropriate for a Democratic candidate to be associated with business practices that Democrats regularly condemn if they're done by people like Mitt Romney. And then others were just saying that it's bad politically, and that she'll, that Walker and company will go after her for it, and she's not going to be able to win.
Right. This won't be a line of attack, probably, at least some analysts have said, that is going to get people to switch allegiance from Mary Burke to Governor Walker's reelection. Could it be something that gets those progressive Democrats you mentioned, labor Democrats, to be less enthusiastic about going around, knocking on doors, maybe less likely to come out and vote?
Maybe. I don't know if that's the intention of Walker's ad, though. I think he's aiming more towards swing voters, people who aren't, most people in the state, even if they affiliate with one side of the aisle, their positions aren't necessarily in lockstep with conservative or progressive political ideology. Things like outsourcing are issues that resonate with people all over the political spectrum. Those are the types of people I think he's aiming for. I don't think that the specific intent of this ad campaign is to depress the Democratic base. Speaking in broad generalizations, I think the Democratic base is pretty committed to getting out to vote against Walker. Certainly the leadership in labor organizations and whatnot hasn't shown any hesitancy in getting behind her candidacy.
Now, in response to Governor Walker's ads, the Mary Burke campaign has fired back. Also on the outsourcing issue, what sorts of things have she and Democrats been talking about when it comes to Governor Walker and the outsourcing issue?
Right. They've said that they've blamed the Walker administration for awarding grants and other types of government assistance through the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which the Walker administration runs, for awarding such assistance to companies that offshore jobs. They argue that it's inappropriate for companies that are receiving taxpayer assistance to be apparently using some of that money to set up jobs abroad instead of here. That line of attack is relatively predictable. It's something you would expect from a challenger, especially a Democratic challenger of an incumbent.
And Governor Walker's in the news today saying he'd consider a rule that would limit WEDEC, the development corporation, and have some kind of strings attached to try to prevent companies receiving support from WEDEC moving, he said, I think something like around the world or even across the border to Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, again, it's an interesting response. Last year, there have been Democratic efforts in the past in the legislature to tie more strings to government contracts to incentivize the use of American-made products or companies that use American-made products. And Republicans pretty forcefully rejected that effort last year. You can talk to, and I remember Speaker Robin Voss was, described it as an absolute, a political stunt that they would, try and, have the demagogue on this issue as he, it'll be interesting to see if Republicans, all get behind Walker and say, yeah, we're going to, make sure that no money goes abroad.
You mentioned that you had heard from a couple of business leaders in the state on this outsourcing issue. One big business voice in the state you hadn't heard from as of publication time, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. Have you heard from them yet?
No. And that's not particularly surprising. WMC doesn't typically return my calls, but the WMC, is the state's most important business group. It's a very powerful interest that for definitely more than a decade has been highly strongly aligned with the Republican Party and has already spent millions of dollars supporting Governor Walker through ads that tout his alleged economic successes of his administration. And it would be interesting to see what they have to say about, Governor Walker, who's supposed to be a champion of the free market, going after a company for offshoring jobs. The companies that make up WMC, a large percent of them, at the very least, are definitely engaged in offshoring to some extent, or buy products from companies that offshore. So, but I don't expect them to condemn Walker the way that some others on the right have, because they're so closely aligned with the Republican Party and they desperately want to see him get reelected.
Jack, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Jack Craver, reporter for the Capital Times. Ever since the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis of 1979, the U.S. and Iran have been at odds with each other. The distrust that exists between the two nations has played a role in a lot of geopolitical events over the last 30 years. That tension remains today in key issues like nuclear negotiations with Iran, which have just been prolonged for another 4 months.
The tone of U.S.-Iran relations has a significant effect on the Middle East and the rest of the world, particularly on issues like the ongoing availability of energy resources, the escalating extremism in the region, Israeli-Palestinian conflict resolution, and the crises in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon.
What's the cause of the ongoing rift between Iran and the U.S.? How will it affect key events going forward? How can the two sides come together to work toward increased stability and peace in the region?
Sayed Hossein Mousavian is with us now. He grew up in Iran and served as former Iranian ambassador to Germany and as Iran's nuclear negotiator. He's now a researcher at Princeton University. His latest book is Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace. Ambassador Mousavian, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Well, the U.S. and Iran have been at odds for over three decades now. What would you say lies at the root of this mistrust on both sides?
Actually, the mistrust is mutual. Americans, they do not trust Iran because of the events like 1979 hostage crisis. They believe Iranians are supporting the militant group deemed a terrorist by the U.S. They believe Iran is provoking anti-Americanism. They are afraid of Iran's role and influence in the region. On the issues like terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, Arab-Israeli peace process, these are major issues. Americans, they do not trust Iran. Iranians also, they have almost 6 years of history mistrusting the U.S., beginning from 1953. CIA backed a coup d'etat, ousting a very popular democratically elected prime minister. And then the U.S. Installed a dictator, a very corrupted dictator, supported for 25 years. Even after revolution, right after revolution, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran, killing or injuring over 1 million people. The U.S. supported the aggressor, Saddam Hussein. Saddam used chemical weapons, 100,000 Iranians, they were killed. Unfortunately, the U.S. provided material and technology for Saddam Hussein attacking Iran by chemical weapons, or downing Iranian passenger flight, killing 292 passengers, all type of sanctions, pressures, even sabotage against Iranian nuclear program, assassination of nuclear scientists. They have a long list of reasons to mistrust each other.
And how does that legacy of mistrust, founded in many cases, as you say, impact the issues at hand today?
I think right after election, we had a very good beginning when the two foreign ministers, John Kerry and Javad Zarif, they met each other. Then we had multiple meetings at the level of deputy ministers. And for the first time, Iran and the U.S. experienced, if they sit together in a good way, with goodwill, and discuss very sincerely and openly their views on one of the most delicate and complicated international issues, which is the nuclear, they can find a way to resolve. And fortunately, after just 3-4 months of direct high-level talks, we had interim deal between Iran and the world powers. We could only reach the interim deal because of direct talks between Iran and the U.S. We failed 10 years of nuclear negotiation only because we didn't have direct talks between Iran and the U.S. Therefore, this is a very good experience, a very good legacy for Iran and the U.S. to sit together, to negotiate for the way forward. I believe we need to immediately resolve the nuclear issue. The good news is that Iranians, it is now very clear for America and for American negotiation team that Iranians are ready to comply at the maximum level of transparency and cooperation with International Atomic Energy Organization. And therefore, they need to resolve the nuclear issue immediately and then to have a comprehensive package, a comprehensive dialogue with step-by-step approach. I mean, they need to negotiate on all the issues, on Iraq crisis, Syrian crisis, Afghanistan crisis, drug trafficking, many other issues. However, they need to have a phased approach practically.
You say that these issues, in particular, the nuclear negotiations need to be resolved quickly and that we are in a good place in terms of transparency on the Iranian side. But on the American side, there is criticism already that transparency is not the same thing as a concession and that Iran is not giving up as much as it is getting. How does the U.S. walk that line?
Actually, Americans, they do not say exactly like this because on transparency measures, the members of Non-Proliferation Treaty, NPT, they all are members of Safeguard Agreement. But one-third of the countries internationally, they have not signed to the other protocols, like additional protocol, which gives additional inspection, like Subsidiary Arrangement Code 3.1, which gives more inspection. Now, Iran is ready to sign off with all protocols and arrangements which would give the maximum level of transparency internationally, because the other arrangements like additional protocol is voluntarily. Two-thirds of international countries, they have accepted. One-third, they have not. 80 countries, they do not implement additional protocol. Therefore, this would be a concession. More. Yeah, Americans and the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Organization, they are asking Iran for a period, even access beyond non-proliferation treaty. And Iranians, they have shown they are ready for a specific period as a confidence building to give access beyond additional protocol, beyond NPT.
I want to move on and look at the situation with Iraq and how it affects the United States and Iran. What would you say Iran's long-term objectives are when it comes to dealing with Iraq?
See, for a decade, despite of all hostilities Iran and the U.S. they have had during last 35 years, in last decades, on issue like Iraq, despite of all animosity between Tehran and Washington, they both have supported the same government. And the U.S. allies in the region, they have challenged Maliki government in Iraq. Tehran and Washington, they have been in the same side, one. And another issue, Afghanistan, is exactly the same. For a decade, Tehran and Washington, they have supported the same government in Afghanistan. And the U.S. allies, they have challenged Karzai, supporting Taliban and extremists in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There is a great amount of understanding now between Tehran and Washington that the rising the threat of terrorism from the Middle East is going to bring the Middle East to a total collapse. And this is the most important threat to the national security and interests of Europe, U.S., Iran, and even the regional countries. And here the U.S. and Iran, they have common interests to cooperate to fight terrorism. They have a very good experience, historical experience, when in 2001, Iran and the U.S. shaked hands and jointly, shoulder by shoulder, they fought against terrorism, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and they removed Taliban from Afghanistan. This is a very good example how Iran and the U.S., they can cooperate. And little by little, I think Tehran and Washington, now they understand, although they have differences, but they have many issues of common interest communities.
And we have to leave it there. Ambassador Mousavian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
That was Syed Hossein Mousavian, former Iranian ambassador to Germany and former Iranian nuclear negotiator. His latest book is called Iran and the United States, an insider's view on the failed past and the road to peace.
We talk with a Navy surgeon who's worked in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's accompanied President Clinton to China as a trauma surgeon on call. And he was there the day Representative Gabrielle Giffords was shot in Tucson, Arizona in 2011.
Dr. Peter Reed joins us now. He's the chief of trauma, critical care, emergency surgery, and burns at the University of Arizona Medical Center and a retired U.S. Navy captain. His new book is called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. Dr. Reed, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm honored.
You open your book with the day of the Tucson shooting, the day Representative Gabrielle Giffords was shot. What happened that day as you remember it?
Well, I was hoping that it was a day off for me, but it turned out in the middle of a Saturday morning, a little bit more chaotic than that. And unfortunately, we have these types of mass casualties, whether it's from car accidents and pileups on the road or from gunshot wounds and stabbings, a little bit more frequently than our society deserves.
And right away, you thought that her chances were good. You were on the line with someone who was with her, a paramedic, said that she had squeezed his hand, kicked her foot, and you thought that is good news. Why did you think that?
Well, you know, as you know, being shot in the brain is not what fills hearts with a lot of hope. It is pretty dramatic in our country. We have over about 11,000 people who shoot themselves, so we have an experience with what happens when a bullet traverses into your brain. And, you know, there's going to be long-lasting effects. So in our country, about the survival rate for that, if the bullet goes into your brain, used to be about 10%. Now it's gone up in our institution to about 46%, but it all depends on what the bullet has hit. And when she came in and when I heard that she could think, that she could process instruction, and then she could follow commands, I knew that her chances of survival were obviously much better than somebody who had come in and already brain dead or in an even worse state.
The nation's attention was on Tucson, was on Representative Giffords the day of that shooting, along with the rest of the victims that day. But you say it doesn't matter to you who is coming into you, who you're treating. It doesn't matter if they are on the wrong side of the law, if they're famous. You treat them all the same. How did you get to that point?
Well, you know, it's our training. We're not supposed to be judge and jury. Sometimes we have people that may not be the fine points of our society, and sometimes we have very important people that are there as well. But I am not the judge nor the jury, and I think as a physician, what you want me to do is to treat every human being the same and give them our full effort every single time they come into the hospital.
And right away, you start the story with the first person who came into your trauma room that day, and it wasn't Gabrielle Giffords. It was a six-year-old girl, and it was an incredible story, what people went through trying to save her. Can you tell us that story about the first victim that day?
Right. So, you know, the thing about that is that, you know, it was many things that was good about that day. Obviously, when you have, in our town, you know, the instance of where this happened in the shopping center in that part of town is a fairly affluential town, part of town. And, you know, it's one of the safest places, I think, in America. And something like this occurs is just not expecting. And people were there, and one of the innocent victims from this whole process was a nine-year-old girl. And there's a lot of goods and bads about this, you know, but they wanted to make as much of an effort as they could because she was a child and they were doing CPR at the shopping center on her. So they brought her in and got to the hospital first. Dr. Rain DeFreeze was on call that morning. And again, the good part about this is that it was Saturday morning. So Saturday morning, we have many doctors in the hospital. We have the team from Friday night that had not gone home yet. We had the team that were coming into work that Saturday. And then we also have trauma surgeons who were taking care of patients in the ICU. So we had many sets of hands who were trauma surgeons, attendings, and residents in the hospital. And as you can imagine, the operating room, which is normally packed on a busy Monday, was empty because we only do a shorter abbreviated schedule on Saturdays. So we had empty operating rooms where we could take patients to as well. So there were many things about that particular morning that I think we were lucky about. But when the patient came in, we had heard that she was having CPR done, which means that the chances of bringing someone back from a gunshot wound, if they're doing CPR in the field, is very, very low. But because this isn't like when I was in the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, I have pretty much all the basic supplies and resources in terms of people and gear, equipment here. So they wanted to go ahead and give them an effort without, I hate to use the word, but wasting too much things and equipment and blood and so on this person. So they had made a pact in the beginning. We're going to try everything for this girl. And yet at the same time, we know we've got many more coming in. So we don't want to risk the lives of people who can be saved on somebody who cannot. So she ended up undergoing a dramatic procedure where they opened the chest and tried to resuscitate her, but she was not survivable.
And you write that there are 30,000 gunshot deaths per year, including suicides, accidents, and homicides like this one. And at one point in the book, you say that you wish that everyone could see what you saw in the trauma room, that you think it would change things, including things like the death of this 9-year-old girl that day. What would change if people could see what you saw?
Well, I think our country has a fascination with guns. And as a society, I don't have any qualms about what we decide to do about having the availability of guns. I think they just need to be educated. If after the information is available to them and they decide that everybody's right is to have an assault rifle, handguns loaded in their bedrooms and whatnot, then that's okay. But as long as the society understands what the consequences are and what the costs are to our society. In the United States, a person is shot with a gun every 5 minutes, and a person dies from a bullet every 16.4 minutes. Every year, an estimated 105,000 people are shot, and 32,000 people die as a result. You know, this is 88 people a day dying from gunshot wounds. And if you want to compare that to the experience that I had during my Navy time periods in Afghanistan and Iraq, there's less than 200 people that die from gunshot wounds a year over the 13 years that we've been in the war. So, you know, how do you compare 200 deaths in a war from bullets versus 88 a day in our country? And I think if we know those numbers and know what it means to have this many guns around, and if we decide that we want to proliferate on this, and that's so be it, I will support whatever society deems necessary. But I think that kind of information is somewhat useful.
And what you see every day is it's literally heart-wrenching. There are days when you're holding someone's heart in your hands, and you write that there are days where you have to have Kevlar around your heart. You have to protect your heart so that you can do your job. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we do get numb to this, and it becomes an everyday occurrence. So you can see it in the eyes of the medical students that we train. You know, they come out of the classroom, they come to the hospital, and the first night on call they see this, and their jaws are open and they had no idea. And I think that's the point, is the reason why I wrote the book, is to give people an idea, things that are invisible to them normally, because we get numb to it and we get used to it too often. If in most cities that they reported who was shot, I think people would get bored of that story, so they want to turn their attention to something else. And that's because it happens so frequently. If you go to other countries, it's not like that. So with that kind of exposure and volume of injury and devastation that goes on, you know, sometimes as a physician, you do end up having to put a little bit of distance from yourself emotionally. And once in a while, you do get caught up on, you know what, this could be my child, this could be my family member who are injured like this.
And one thing it sounds like you always do is when you lose a patient, you apologize to them. What do you say, and what does that do for you, and what do you think it does for them?
You know, every time I do this, I feel awkward. And that's usually what I find after the math, after the efforts have been done, that your emotions do come out a little bit. But you want to apologize to the patients for their demise, and even though you've tried everything else. But I think it's also very important that when I do that, I also don't do it necessarily for the patient. I do it for myself, but most importantly, I do it for my teammates who are in the room, the operating room technicians, the anesthesiologists, the ER techs, the nurses, the radiology techs, the residents, and everybody to know that this is just not just another body, but it was a human being just a few minutes ago.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Ree. He's the chief of trauma, critical care, emergency surgery, and burns at the University of Arizona Medical Center, and he's a retired U.S. Navy captain. His new book with Gordon Dillo is called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. We're talking with Dr. Peter Ree now. He's the chief of trauma, critical care, emergency surgery, and burns at the University of Arizona Medical Center. He's the author of the new book, Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities. And Dr. Ree, one thing you like to do is to stay on the cutting edge of technology. You want to advance the cause of things that are going to keep patients alive longer. And one of those that you've worked with is something called Quick Clot. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. You know, we in the military medicine, when we do research, sometimes we say we always practice based on the last war. And what we found was that people who were shot, what we call junctional areas, like in the groin or in your armpit, is very difficult for us to control bleeding there. Because if it was in your lower arms or legs, you can put on a tourniquet. And I think everybody kind of knows that you strap something on to stop the bleeding, and you can do that. But when they have it in these areas, we're finding a lot of difficulty in controlling their bleeding. So when I came back from Afghanistan the first time, right after 9/11, the United States Navy asked me to look at a couple of products that were promising. And when we tested this in animals, we found one particular product, which wasn't our primary interest, but it was a product called Quick Clot at that time, was this kitty litter looking kind of thing that soaks up in the blood and actually helps coagulate and stop bleeding right away. And as a result of our animal research showing that it was so effective, we were able to get this through the FDA very quickly and deploy it out into Afghanistan and Iraq with the United States Marine. And it has undoubtedly saved a lot of lives we would have otherwise lost.
And one thing you're looking forward to down the road, you seem pretty confident that one day we will have synthetic blood.
Yes. I mean, the reason why we don't have it now is because we think, or we used to think, that the fluids that we resuscitate or replaced blood with was adequate. But in the last two decades, we know that when we give saline or these solutions through the vein, it's really good for people who are dehydrated. But when we try to replace large volumes of blood loss with it, that we have been causing all sorts of problems, and that we didn't recognize this until about 10 years ago. And so when we started to wonder, you know, well, what can we make in replacement of blood? And that's when we started to all of a sudden realize, you know what? Blood is immensely complex. It's not just red cells and white cells, but as you know, it has all sorts of proteins, so many proteins that we can't even name them, hormones, signaling factors that are in there, and so on. And that the way we generally think of replacing it is absolutely rudimentary, and it's almost as ridiculous as the days when we used to put leeches on people to drain the blood. Hmm. You know, when we used to bleed people on purpose to get rid of the bad blood, or put leeches on them, get rid of blood, and so on. At that time, you know, they were convinced that that was the right thing to do. But as we find out how complex blood is, I think eventually we will be able to make a biomachinery that will make synthetic blood that has all of those types of proteins involved, so we don't have to try to replace it with just red cells or white cells.
Now, it's been a long journey for you to become the surgeon that you are today. Your family came from North Korea to South Korea to Africa to the United States. And you watched your father, who was a doctor himself, originally a surgeon, in fact, all those years, and you didn't want to be a doctor. You wanted to be an aerospace engineer. Somewhere along the way, a transformation happened. What do you think it was that turned you into a surgeon?
I can tell you exactly what it was. I went to Georgia Tech. I was good in science in high school, and the application to that school was very cheap. It was only $3 back then. And aerospace was the first box in the A's that you could check off. So that's why I decided to do that. And being a Korean descent, as the stigmata is and the stereotype is, you know, there was a lot of pressure from the family to be either a doctor or a lawyer and things like that. And so it was just a matter of rebellion, I guess, for a while until I went away and saw the light. And it was because I went on a computer at that time, which where you put in all your likes and dislikes and trying to figure out what jobs that they recommend. And for some reason, every single time, no matter what variables I changed, physicians seemed to come up at the top. And that was the reason why I chose it.
It was doctor over and over again.
Yes.
And you discovered you have good hands. What does that mean? I've always been curious. When you say a surgeon has good hands, what does that mean?
Well, actually, it's a combination of things. I think the most important thing is judgment. You have to have good judgment. You have to have common sense as to what's required and not. And then having the technical capability to cut and sew and have your hands do what you want it to do is a luxury, but it's not an absolute requirement nowadays. But my mother's an artist, and I used to draw and do a lot of artwork in the past as well. So I think my mind is just set up that way, where I'm very three-dimensionally oriented, and the manual dexterity for those kinds of things is it comes a little bit easier by nature for me.
Well, I want to go back to that day in your trauma room with your team, the day Gabrielle Giffords was shot, the shooting in Tucson in 2011. You got a call from the President of the United States at one point. Did that surprise you?
You know, actually, because of my previous experience with the prior administrations and learning the inner workings of the White House, it wasn't. The funny part was I had my cell phone on and I had my Bluetooth headgear on. And in the midst of all of this, I get a phone call. I hear it ringing in my ear. I look down, and it's got a 202 area code, which is Washington, D.C. And because Gabrielle Giffords was a congresswoman, I knew exactly who it was. So when I picked up the phone, the person that I was talking to was Commander Ronnie Jackson, who I was in Iraq with. He had come through my training program in Los Angeles, where we used to train Navy surgeons. And we were in Al-Takadum in Iraq when he got the announcement that he was going to be part of the White House physician group. And lo and behold, it was Ronnie Jackson. He got on the phone and said, "Captain Reed, this is Ronnie." quickly got on to business, and he said that he was looking for an update, and I was able to do so. And I think that connection was part of the reason why President Obama eventually came out to Tucson.
With so much attention focused there on your medical center, did you feel that this was not, no matter what you might tell yourself, this was not just an ordinary day of treating people whose bodies were injured? Did this become something more to you?
Well, you know, I didn't know it at the time, right? And I didn't know it until after the evolution of what happened. To be honest with you, that day was, probably the second most great day at work. You know, I had days in Iraq, I think, that I felt was my battle of the bulge with mass casualties there, with 70, 80 people coming in through your surgical facility when there's only you and one other surgeon. That was a true challenge, you know, being out in the field with no gear. But the antithesis of that was all of a sudden Saturday, with more help than I could use, everything working well, people working in cooperation, having all the resources that you wanted, and everything going so well. It was, you know, the two extreme opposites. And then, you know, important people, you know, I don't know what the definition of important people are, but I think now I know the definition of popular people. And as the TV crews and cameras started lining up outside the hospital, it was almost comical as it was evolving as to how much press that we had gotten. Because this kind of activity goes on in many places, but it's probably just not as popular or remembered because of the people that are involved.
Wasn't there one point where you went outside to brief people on Gabrielle Giffords' condition as she improved, and lo and behold, people applauded you, and it took you a second there.
Yeah, I didn't understand what was going on. And as I reflect back on it, I think what they were trying to do was just trying to put some light into such a bad event. And they were just happy for our medical system, the way it worked. And I was just a spokesperson for a very good system that had been put into place. You know, the main reason why I wrote this book is to explain to people what a trauma surgeon is. We're sitting around and estimating that in our country, over 250 million people know what a brain surgeon is or a heart surgeon is, but a very, very small number of people, less than maybe even 100,000, know what a trauma surgeon is. So with this new field that's relatively new, you know, we didn't have this in the 70s. It's a relatively new field that's evolved. We're, I think, fairly sophisticated now. We have probably one of the best systems in the world. We just wanted to, you know, tell the people what they have and how fortunate we are in this country.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Peter Reed, the Chief of Trauma, Critical Care, Emergency Surgery, and Burns at the University of Arizona Medical Center. He's also a retired U.S. Navy captain. His new book, it's called Trauma Red, The Making of a Surgeon in War and in America's Cities.